Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another installment of Listener Emails with the hosts of the Fourth Age podcast. I, of course, am Andrew Gellis, and with us this time is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back, as always, and we also have joining us tonight, Spencer.
Hey, everyone. It is great to be here. As Andrew said, we're doing listener emails. Listener feedback in the form of emails. It's been a while since we've done an email episode. In fact, I don't think that since I've actually been on the podcast that we've done one. So we have quite a few of them built up. I think, though, most of these are post Towers of Midnight, the ones that we're going to be talking about tonight. But we do want to make sure that everyone knows that we are talking about all of the books in the series, including Towers of Midnight, so expect spoilers.
You will be spoiled. And we might spoil other series as well, books, movies, magazines, anything you think of that comes across in the course of the conversation about the Wheel of Time might possibly be mentioned, and we'll try to warn you if possible, but we don't always even consider that you might actually not have read everything in the world.
So we're going to begin. Our first email comes from Anson, and if I mispronounce anyone's name, I am horribly, terribly sorry. We'll get to pronunciations and languages later in the episode. Anson asks us, I would like your take on the chapter in which Avienda sees what appears to be the future of the Aiel. I would like to believe that the future is not set in stone, but this appears to be a doom of a different sort that would befall the people of Randland. So do you think that the visions are set in stone if Rand fails the last battle? I personally like to think that this is just a possibility and it can be changed. Could this be the second doom that Ishamiel spoke of to Rand in the Eye of the World?
I had rather thought that the second doom that Ishamiel spoke of was the Shanchen, Arthur Hawkwing sending Luther's son, Luther Pendrag, across the ocean, thus sealing two dooms. I believe it even says that somewhere, but I can't remember where.
I think part of it, at least in my thought here, is that there is a definite possibility, because we've now been introduced in Towers of Midnight to the concept that the dark prophecies in which Ishamiel has been working off of has been in compilation for who knows how long, but he has an entire compendium of dark prophecies of which we don't know, and it's very possible that in the Dark Friend prophecies, there was something which stated that there had to be this other force that would invade. And, you know, therefore the idea of Ishamiel getting Arthur Hawkwing to send, you know, his son and, you know, the armada across the ocean would make a great deal of sense, because then the founding of the Shanchen Empire was specifically set up in order to try to prevent victory by the light in the last battle, which would also factor into why the Shanchen are such a big sticking point and problem for the people of Randland.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. But going back a little bit to the real heart of the question, which was, are Avienda's visions a prophecy that's doomed to become real, or is it more in the nature of what they see going through the rings when they go to be wise ones? You know, in other words, they meant to be a warning. And is she really the first person ever to actually turn around and go back into the ring? I mean, into the columns? Well, that seems odd that everybody would be so rule-obeying.
Well, I don't know that it's the fact that she went back through the columns that is why she saw the visions of the future. I think a big reason is because of her own ability with Tarangriel. It read to me like she somehow influenced the Angriel, or maybe like flipped some metaphysical switch to make it do what she wanted it to do. As far as do I think the future set in stone, no. I do think that this is a possible future that we can see. And we've seen it many times in the Wheel of Time, is that there's kind of two kinds of future seeing that we have. We have men's visions, which are very much, these are going to happen. But we have other things, like you mentioned the rings in Ruidian, or the weird things that happened in Great Hunt when they traveled by Portal Stone. And I think there's some others that some dreams I think are the same way. I could be wrong about that one though. But where it's much more fluid, it's a possibility if things are not fixed. So we know that there is a way, or that there are viewings where if things are not fixed, yes, this is going to happen, but you have time to change it. And I think now that Avienda knows that it needs changing, I mean, she knows why this future happens, and she knows what she can do to help fix it. I don't think that it's as big of a fear as it would be without her having that knowledge. I mean, because the entire basis of the war between the Aiel and the Seanchan, which, of course, provokes the war between the Seanchan and the rest of the world, is that the Aiel are left to their own devices. The Dragon Reborn, it says straight out that Rand had no idea what to do with them, and so he left them to their own devices. And, well, what are we supposed to do? Well, let's have a war. Why not? And so now that she knows what she needs to do, that she needs to go to Rand, she needs to help him learn more of the Aiel and their customs and figure out what he needs to have them do after the last battle, then I think we're not likely to see that future.
Well, the other thing, and I think a lot also depends on what happens not just to Rand, but one of the things that I found extremely suspicious in all of those viewings is that none of the major players from this time are around at all. Rand seems to have just disappeared. He left. That's all anyone says. No one even mentions Elaine or Avienda or anyone else that we would know from the series. It's as if at some point they all just kind of vanished. I think a lot of it, you know, taking off of what you said, Spencer, depends on interaction between parent and child and grandparent and grandchildren, because, you know, if Avienda has, you know, any amount of influence over her children and her grandchildren, then obviously, yes, knowing what she knows now, she could just, you know, smack him upside the head and be like, no, you're being stupid. Pay attention.
Yeah, especially a wise one.
But I mean, like, if Rand disappears and takes Elaine and Avienda with him, you know, the magic, oh, I'm suddenly taken up and deified, you know, or whatever happens, then, you know, oh, shoot, guess you guys can handle things on your own. Try not to get into any war with the Seanchan that's going to end the world and destroy our civilizations as we know it. Good luck with that.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it really, I mean, they said point blank that Rand's children didn't know him. I mean, the point of view we got from his daughter, she asked one of her friends about him, one of her friends who had Rurark's son, who, you know, has been alive and had actually gotten to meet him on at least one occasion, but she herself hadn't ever met him, and I think that is a big thing that would, if I had seen through the eyes of one of my children and they didn't know their other parents, I think I would take steps to make sure that didn't happen. no matter what the outcome of it, I would make sure that my children knew both their parents if it were possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is really interesting, especially when we get into the second generation, you know, her granddaughter, the way that she thinks about Elaine's granddaughter. I mean, Avi and Elaine are first sisters. Elaine's a Wetlander, but still, they're first sisters, and that's a special bond in Aiel culture, and her granddaughter doesn't care about it at all. She's more concerned about the fact that she's the daughter of the dragon, one of the blood of the dragon, and that this other lady that she's going to meet also has a claim to that same title, even though she doesn't really like her, and she shouldn't, but too bad she does, rather than thinking that their great mothers were first sisters.
Well, in that way, she's almost like, as horrible for me to say this is, and that the granddaughter is kind of like Savannah a little bit. I mean, the idea of titles and you know, things like that is clearly just a manifestation of their new life in the wetlands. The other thing, it had just occurred to me, is that if we take Avienda's visions to be set in stone, that also definitely sets that, well, in that case, Rand has to win the last battle, because they mention him winning the last battle in the visions, and that he left afterwards. I mean, it's one of those things that, I mean, of course, we can't ever have anything 100% set in stone in the way of prophecies, visions, or anything like that, because history hasn't happened yet. While it is impossible for, you know, Rand to travel back in time and keep Luz Thurin from trying to seal the boar by him, you know, men. You know, that obviously can't happen. History is immutable, but what Avienda has seen hasn't happened yet. So obviously there's always a chance that something can occur so that things won't turn out that same way.
Yeah.
I'm guessing the reason when Wise Ones return to Rhuiteen the second time, why they remember some things of what they see and other things that they don't. Right? They remember some things that they have seen and don't remember other things is because that first Tarangriel they go through presents life in such variation that it is literally giving you thousands of possible choices, basically giving you a window to the multiverse of cosmic time and causality. Therefore, you know, the ones that are on track with what you are doing are the ones you're going to remember and be like, oh, okay, there we go. I apologize for the amazing sci-fi techno babble there for a second, because that's just a little more complicated than I tend to like to explain my chaos string theory and other sorts of things like that.
Well, it's clear to me the Wise Ones have a quantum mirror stashed somewhere, right?
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, let me tell you. You know, I think, though, that on the question of, well, we know that Rand has to win because we've seen visions of the future where he wins, I think that was answered pretty well, and I'm almost positive that this was by RJ in the end of The Gathering Storm, where the Aes Sedai, I don't even remember which one, says that she's not worried about the last battle because Min's had visions that have to happen after the last battle, so we don't have to worry. We know that we're going to win. But, you know, I think Min puts it right on the nose. Well, if the Dark One wins, there is no pattern. I'm just reading the pattern. If the Dark One wins, the pattern's gone.
Yeah, and I mean, I completely agree with that sentiment.
From our standpoint as readers, well, I doubt very much that Robert Jordan would be so cruel as to have the good guys lose. We can't rely on them to tell us that.
Before we move on to the next email, I just wanted to go through and insert
I don't get to give my comment on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry.
Not yet.
Sorry.
I'm trying not to speak over anybody, and then I never get to talk.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I don't know. I don't really have anything more to say about it. I just don't know that it's going to be carved in stone. That's an awfully bleak future to look forward to, and I hope that it's not true. And the whole point of that Tehran Grail is to guide people in the direction that will keep them from doing that. You know, the things that cause those features. But I still am very curious as to how apparently being this one first, if not the first to go through that again, it may be all of those who managed to make it through the first time, if they start to go back through again, were completely overwhelmed by the horrible, horrible future that they were doomed to. And, you know, went the way of, was it Muradin, Culloden's brother, who did
yes.
not survive his trip to the columns? Yeah. So maybe that's sort of self-explanatory. There might have been others who did go, turn around and go back through. I think that, I don't know that she triggered anything by touching the Tehran Grail. I think she just getting close enough to it to get sucked back in was probably enough to trigger it for the second round. I think they were probably warned not to do that because, you know, people don't usually really need to know their future. That could be really more destructive than almost anything.
Yeah, I know there was, when she was, for lack of a better term, when she was delving the Tehran Grail, there was this sense of, trying to find the exact word in the book, and I'm not going to be able to find it. It was like
almost
it was sentient.
Yeah.
Yeah. I imagine it is a function of the Tehran Grail that going through one harrowing experience is enough to ward anyone away from going through them again. I don't necessarily know. I think my personal opinion is she probably did trigger something by trying to shift and make it do something else. She reset it, like just basically flipping the reset switch on it. But if it does have a certain amount of sentience, it would also, the Tehran Grail would be able to read the fact that going through and seeing the Aiel past really didn't have any effect on her whatsoever. As a matter of fact, it exacerbated her problem. You know, she was already suffering an extreme lack of faith, for lack of a better term, when she went through it the first time. And, you know, she came out and she's like, wow, that was singularly unimpressive. And, you know, I don't really feel like I've accomplished anything. You know, I came here and, yeah, I found out that what Rand said is true, but I kind of already guessed that. So, you know, what do I get out of this trip? And, you know, the machine went, we can work with that. You want knowledge?
Watch this.
We'll give you some knowledge. Slam.
Watch this.
Yeah, so.
That's a rather sinister name, The Machine.
The Machine.
No one survives The Machine.
So before we leave this particular email, I did want to put in there, since it was mentioned and we talked about it pretty much in the beginning, the exact quote about the dooms. This is a Shamiel speaking. He says, I whispered in Archer Hawkwing's ear, and the length and breadth of the land Aes Sedai died. I whispered again, and the High King sent his armies across the Aerith Ocean, across the World Sea, and sealed two dooms. The doom of his dream of one land and one people, and a doom yet to come. At his deathbed, I was there when his counselors told him only Aes Sedai could save his life. I spoke, and he ordered his counselors to the stake. I spoke, and the High King's last words were a cry that Tar Valon must be destroyed. And when I'm looking at that, we know that the Finns told Rand that essentially the land had to all be as one. And I'm guessing Shamiel had access to a prophecy that basically told them the equivalent that if the entire land is united as one people, the light's going to win. So obviously he shatters Hawkwing's empire, which had essentially accomplished that one goal. And at the same time, he knows that the Aes Sedai are going to be a thorn in his side. So if he can instill in a group of people like Luthair Paindrag and his descendants that, oh, the High King's last words were that Tar Valon had to be crushed. You know, we've now seen Tuan order a second attack on the White Tower.
Yep.
And it just seems to me that it's like, that seems a lot like dark prophecy at work. So it is very probable because, as we've seen in Avienda's visions, the Shanshan really stepped up, collaring anyone and everyone who could channel at all, regardless. And it just seems that, yeah, that it could very well tie in.
But it's something that we're just going to have to probably raffle at this point. We'll have to just read and find out. So our next email comes from Chad, and he writes in that, actually wrote to me, and he said he's finally getting around to listening to the TGS Recap podcast, and says, I just had to tell you I thoroughly enjoyed the stint on breeding and genetics. It was humorously informative. A lot of you know I'm sort of I'm an amateur dog breeder and genetics buff, and so I guess I was holding forth at great length, as usual, on the genetics of the One Power, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm glad that not everybody was totally put to sleep by that. Anyway, this turned into sort of an ongoing email conversation for the next few days, where we had any number of emails back and forth, some of which are completely irrelevant. But in one of his next ones, he writes, also, just a suggestion or request, you should all consider doing an entire Elida show. I know she's horrible, but in light of Sufi's discovery, is it Sufi or Sufa?
Sufa. S-U-F-F-A.
Right.
Yeah. That would actually probably be Sufa, so they're probably pronouncing it right in the audiobooks. Okay.
I say Sufa, because it sounds better.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Sounds more Shanshan,
anyway,
to my mind.
I know she's horrible, but in light of Sufa's discovery, or Sufa, and how wretched she showed herself to be, offering to trade help and other Aes Sedai so that she could go free, plus the ramifications of Padme Thane's touch, there's just so much there. I get bogged down in the details, but when you look at Elida as a character, she is probably one of the best villains in literature, especially from the standpoint that she doesn't even see herself as a villain the way most do. Anyway, just a suggestion. And also, he writes, I wanted to make a comment about Morneth and Thane's touch. I know his touch can affect anyone, but I think partially you have to have a personality that is susceptible for it to really do damage. There was a reason why he went to Eridol and not Manethrin. There was a reason why it was Matt and not Perrin Arand who took the dagger. There was a reason why Thane became so utterly possessed and why it was Elida and Niall and certain White Clucks who were so much more influenced by him than others. Thane may think that a chance encounter is enough, but I think either he is drawn to susceptible personalities, they to him, or some combination. Not that there wouldn't be any effect on, say, Egwene, but it would probably not be as damaging, long-lasting, or infectious. Hope it comes up in a future show. I love the podcast.
Ooh, a whole show on Elida.
Yeah,
I don't know if I can make myself do that.
I think we could probably do it. A lot of it would be vitriol, I imagine, because we despise her a lot. But I honestly think we probably could. And when we get back into doing more, you know, full character analysis type things, we'll probably end up touching on her because she is a very focal character throughout a chunk of the series.
She's been in almost every book, hasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Appeared in Out of the World. And,
This is the first, I think this is the book that she's, I think this is the book that she's in the least from all the books that we've had.
Yes,
but I could be completely off my rocker there.
I do have to say that it really warmed the cockles of my heart to imagine her being flown off on the back of a Turrican, shrieking and then throwing up. I'm like, there's justice after all.
I'm sorry. Even as much as I like Matt and Tuan, as much as I hated Elida, I can't be happy no matter who it is being collared.
Oh, I can. I'm mean. I'm sorry. There's two sides of my character that you've never seen before. Hey, it's better than what Andrew Miller wanted to do to her. I mean, he had, you know, like slicing and dicing and everything else going on with her. So,
yeah, just killing her outright, I wouldn't mind that. But being, no, I don't like. Anyway, but yeah, I think you know, character shows, you know, like, I think it'd probably be best if it waited until after A Memory of Light was out and we've had some chance to talk about it. And then we just do character analysis of where they start, where they've been, where they ended up. And, you know, Elida would be a very interesting one to do.
That still makes
you
feel
actually one of, she's actually one of the very few characters who's actually been in all of the books, including the prequel.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wrote back to Chad that I actually think some of the most dangerous villains probably don't see themselves as villains at all. You know, a lot of them just believe they're right, and everyone else is too stupid to see it. And that quickly becomes whatever they want is right, and anyone who stands in their way must be eliminated or neutralized somehow, and that fits good old Elida pretty well. And then I also liked his thoughts about Pad and Fane as well, and I think he's right in a way there. I remember Fane thinking that he could spot a dark friend or even someone who was leaning that way, thinking about swearing to the shadow, as though they had a mark on the forehead. And that made me think of the mark that Alvearon was so worried that Shida Haran had placed on her forehead when they had their little disastrous meeting with Mithana.
Yeah. Pad and Fane and Mordeth are two, I mean, they are two different characters, but they're so entwined that they're basically one. And they are incredibly interesting from a character standpoint. I mean, they're
off
creepy.
The scale on the meter. Yeah.
Scary as hell, but they're very interesting.
Yeah, yeah, definitely off the scale on the creep meter.
I do worry, based on what we saw of Fane in Towers of Midnight, that the influence of what it has become, and I almost can't call it a him anymore.
He's an it.
Has grown to a point that it's just possibly catastrophic and far more infectious or influencing than previous. I mean, at this point, it very much looks as if Fane can raise the dead as zombies. And not just zombies, but like brutal, bloodthirsty zombies. He apparently killed a worm, the thing that gave Lon pause in Eye of the World, with his bare hands. Kind of worry about anything that can do that.
Yeah.
And I mean, just that idea that, you know, suddenly the dead Trollocs are all like diseased, but they like stand up and are shambling along behind. And he's like, oh, you know, they might not work so well on a normal level, but you know, once they get whipped into a blood frenzy, oh, they'll be harder than anything to stop now.
I have to say, I thought that was pure Brandon. Actually, that says Brandon to me. I don't know. I can't prove it. But that fits in a lot more with what some of Brandon's books have had going on than Robert Jordan's. Could be wrong.
I don't know. Hinderstaff was pretty much a zombie. But here's an interesting thing.
I never wanted zombies in the Wheel of Time. I never wanted any zombies in the Wheel of Time. Thanks very much.
I'm going to bring up something now.
Hinderstaff, one of my very least favorite chapters of all.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to bring up something now that I think is probably a lot of the reason why we do these kind of episodes, because I just drew a connection that I don't think I would have otherwise. And the connection I drew is we have Avienda's journey through the Tarangriel again. And honestly, the creature, not the creature, but her granddaughter, the girl that she sees the world through that time, she is kind of a twisted and perverse version of an Aiel. And so I have to wonder how much of that might be the influence of Mordeth.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. Well, she is, I've forgotten her name now, but she is kind of a cross between, an Aiel and maybe Elida or something. It's like, you could cross Elida with a sea folk woman, Windfinder, you know, or mistress of the ships or something, that you might have that annoying. ambitious, self-centered personality that that granddaughter was, where she came up with that, you know, coming out of the Aiel. Yeah, you're right. Savannah is probably as close to it as anything we've seen in the Aiel. Not that common. You know, they don't seem to be, they don't seem to lean that way that much. They kind of grow up in a, you know, a community culture, you know, where they're supportive of one another. I mean, obviously the other clans and everything they raid and so forth and so on, but they don't seem to have the obsessive, ambitious glory drive that a lot of peoples do. You know, like say the Kyrianan who spend their whole lives playing Dias D'Mar in order to get ahead and self-aggrandize themselves, you know.
Yeah. Well, and then the trick that they pull, you know, the keeping
the
away part of the truth or whatever. Yeah, the trick that they pull on Andor, basically, whoever was the Queen of Andor, and I can't remember her name either. But
Talana. I think it was Talana.
Something like that. But, you know, the only thing that we've ever seen in the books, the only Aiel that we've ever seen do anything similar to that, not Savannah, because Savannah just made a mad grab for power and decided she was going to hold on to it. But the one that we've seen do something like that was Kuladin, the Kool-Aid Man. I mean, blatantly lying to the rest of the Aiel and trying to attain power and glory. You know, it's a blatant lie. I mean, it's a lie of omission, but it's still a blatant lie what they did to the rest of the world. Trying to attain the power and glory of war.
Well, even the wise ones had his number right off the bat. And Rudy, and I don't remember if it was Amis or Bear, who said that she could see Kuladin taking his whole clan into outlawry, you know, without even blinking.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The Shai'edo, the Shai'edo were, I think it's not quite the right word, but it's the best word, were kind of shunned by the other Aiel because they were kind of this band of thieving misfits, the approximation of bandits and similar.
I was going to say they're sort of like the Terran ferrymen of the Two Rivers, you know.
yeah, really, they are.
Incidentally, the names of the granddaughters are Onkala and Talana, respectively.
Yeah, I remember Talana.
And also, incidentally, the opinions and. The opinions of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Fourth Age podcast or Dragonmount.com, their owner.
So that if wait a minute, if Dragonmount.com is the owner of the podcast or the podcasters, does that make us Duck O'Vale? Oh, cool.
Basically, we aren't paid to do this.
Yeah, but we can leave anytime we want.
That's true. That's true. It's a volunteer effort, so I guess it's more like, I don't have any ideas.
It's sort of like volunteer to become Doc O'Vale, right? I'm not getting ravens tattooed on my shoulder, sorry.
I wouldn't mind temporary raven tattoos.
Ravens are awesome.
Except that no one would ever see them, because I ain't taking my shirt off. Let me tell you that right now.
You better consult with the rest of your family, though, because, you know, the mark of the raven is forever, and anybody that's down related from you goes right along with you.
Nah.
Might have a few issues with that.
No, seriously, if I existed, and I think I've probably said this before, but if I existed in the world of the Wheel of Time, I would have to be a Death Watch guard. Who got left behind at Falme and swept up by the Black Tower and is now in Ashaman, but that's beside the point.
I should have you pegged for a cup bearer. Really?
Maybe realistically. No, realistically, I'd probably be a farmer someplace.
Yeah. Well, that was
but
too
if I, if I got my, if I got to be whoever I wanted, I'm totally a. What I just said, because I'm not saying it again. It's a bit long.
Well, I was thinking that was what Tuan was always threatening to make Matt her cupbearer. Or a running groom. You know, a running groom. You're pretty fit. You could be a running groom. Yeah. I don't know about those Shanten. Could not live.
As hard as it is to understand Aiel culture, it is difficult to accept Shanshan culture. I mean, I understand their culture perfectly, but I cannot accept it.
Yeah. Just don't want to go there, you know.
Yeah.
Well, the one thing that Chad said in his thing, there was a reason why it was Matt and not Theron Rand who took the dagger. Well, yeah, but Pennfey didn't really have anything to do with that. That was basically...
Well, that was Mordeth, though, which is after that session of the same thing.
Yeah. And he didn't really make him take it. Matt was kind of obsessed with the treasure before Mordeth ever met him.
Yeah, Matt has always been one who was a bit obsessed with wealth until he had it, and then he was just kind of, oh yes, I have money and I'm going to keep it, thank you very much.
Yeah.
But until that point, he was very obsessed with wealth.
Yeah, we see him even mentioning the very first time that the Tower of Genjai is mentioned to him, he said, I'll bet there's treasure in that. I'll bet a place like that would hold treasure. And then Bale Dolan lectures him about how that's not what makes you go see the world. It's the new things and the adventure and the strange and the wondrous that makes you do it, not the treasure. Oh, if you find some king's jewels and gold, all the best. But, you know, that's not the point. And Matt's like, yeah, right.
Well, that was after Shadar Vol'goth, though. So. Dagger taint and all that. Anyway.
Dagger taint. I love it.
I'm allowed to make up nouns and such to describe things.
I found it at the drugstore the other day.
Yeah, maybe the corner drugstore. That's not something you'll find at your local supermarket.
Well.
Anyway, I guess moving on. There's more of this from Chad. He had another good idea. What is the future of the Red and Aja, specifically after Tarmon Gaidon? You know,
the Red and the Green. Actually,
you know, it's really interesting. I mean, Egwene's already said the Red have to have a new purpose because being the men haters and the gentlers cannot happen anymore. The taint is cleansed. We need the men because we're not as strong without them. So you cannot be the man-haters anymore, so you have to change what you're going to be. And I think it's you, Andrew, or it might have been Daniel, but I'm pretty sure it was you who pointed out several times that the Red Aja really are the MPs of the White Tower. They're the policing force for the sisters. And they've kind of morphed that recently into policing force for the men as well. But I think that's really what they're going to become is the policing force for channelers. I mean, the channelers feel like they're the policing force of the world, what have you, especially the White Tower. But someone has to police the policemen. And that's what the Red Aja is for.
Yeah, I remember making that comparison. Actually, I worry a little bit about the Green, not just after the last battle, but now. We've kind of seen that. Yeah, if the Green come up against, you know, a horde of Trollocs or something, then they're good to go. But you set them out of their element at all, and, oh, look, the Shanshan are attacking the tower, and we're effectively useless. Oh, look, blood knives are killing people, and we're essentially useless. And just kind of like, wow, Battle Lodge isn't looking so hot these days.
I know. No, they didn't make much of a showing there in the Battle of the White Tower. I like what Egwene said about them. She reflects that there were a couple of sitters for the Green sitting there, and she said, oh, she said to herself, that's the Aja she would have joined, and they gave her more grief than anyone. Yeah, they kind of do.
You
need to get some leadership going there, you know?
Yeah. I help me remember, because I've read through the book once, and I've been meaning to do another read-through. I just haven't yet. But of all the sisters that Egwene takes with her into the battle for the Tower Tell on Riad edition, where they're fighting Sana and the Black Ajah, how many of those sisters were Greens?
Not many.
Because didn't she take sisters, one, that she trusted, and two, that had enough training in Tel Aaron on Riad to be able to hold their own.
Yep.
And that doesn't necessarily mean greens. I mean, there were... So, as far as the battle Aja, thinking about this, I think I'm going to make another Our World crossover metaphor. And I realize that a lot of our listeners are not in the United States. I am, so it's what I'm going to compare it to, because that's what I know best. But it seems to me like the structure of the White Tower needs to be, it isn't right now, but it kind of needs to be, where the Amyrlin and the Hall of the Tower are kind of the legislative branch, where, and the green is the executive, and the red is the judicial, where, you know, the Amyrlin and the Hall, they're making the laws, the green is kind of the muscle behind enforcing them, and the red is the ones who come in and make sure that you're fairly tried and properly arraigned if you do something wrong.
I mean, I would have said... Between the green and the red, I think that the...
The battle odds really are supposed to be the muscle men, which is what the executive branch is supposed to be. You know, the police force and those responsible for enforcing the laws need to have the muscle behind them to be able to do it. Which is why the military is under the under the control of the president. I don't know. That's just a real world kind of tie-in that I made that may or may not actually make any sense. And you know, it might make more sense for the gray or white Ajas, or gray and white Ajas, to be the legislative branch, and the red and green to be the executive. That actually makes a lot more sense. I don't know what the blue and yellow are doing, though. They're just kind of running around free willy doing stuff. They're like all the charity organizations, you know. All the people running around to make sure everyone's life is good.
Interesting thought. Yeah, I think there are a number of the Ajas that are actually going to have to repurpose a little bit. A lot of it's going to depend on who really survives the last battle. I mean, I could see entire Ajas being almost wiped out, depending on what they're doing.
Yeah.
Where they happen to be at the wrong place, the wrong time. I don't know. That would certainly require a lot of restructuring of the White Tower if you lose a couple of Ajas. I think the green is going to have something a little more than that left after the last battle. But it does make sense that a lot of them wouldn't survive because they're going to probably be on the front lines, you know. And then the next installment in our ongoing email conversation from Chad was, it's too funny.
Probably I just listened. It's the best part.
Actually, we ranted a little bit about how the Aes Sedai managed to lose traveling, which, as you all know, is one of my favorite dead horses to beat. I never can understand how they managed that little stupid trick, but there you go.
Yeah.
At least you didn't eat them.
Anyway, sorry. Anyway, I finally then concluded that there was probably no really good reason why they lost traveling, except that it was a plot device. It's the same reason that RJ didn't give him cell phones or call Tarangriel like Masana gave Elvier, and it would have just made things too different. So then he writes back, exactly, and he says, I promise this will be the last one of the day. Well, it wasn't, but it's okay. Just listen to the conversation, and I do not remember what episode this is, so maybe one of the editors can bring it back in. But he says, I just listened to the conversation where you and Spencer were talking about the usefulness of the Saldaean horse tricks. One of you mentioned circus tricks for the Trollocs. Well, my imagination instantly created the image of Narg and Mrs. Narg taking the kitty Trollocs to the circus for the day. The girl in pink and white polka dots with a bow and the boy in blue overalls with a lollipop. They watch the show, grunt in approval, and then eat the performers. What a fun family Trolloc day, LOL. And then I wrote back, of course, that was too funny. I love the lollipops. But then I wanted to know what are Trolloc lollipops made out of. Probably better not to know. And then, I don't know if I need to put that in. I actually hate that whole conversation because every time I think about this, then I get this stupid circus calliope music in my head, you know. I do not at all. I don't. Apparently, I quote a lot of these in my sleep.
Yeah.
Well, or not. And then, yeah, they were probably good practice, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I only vaguely remember it. But as far as the Trolloc lollipops, you know what it has to be? It's a femur with a pancreas stuck on top.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
Gross.
Yeah, just a little. Okay.
And you know what? I honestly have to I have to give Chad a nod to this particular scenario, in that it brings back that old newsreel I had about the Narg's widow and children suing Rand for Narg's death. I'm so glad that Mrs. Narg has made another appearance in our illustrious podcast history.
Yeah, the Dragon Reborn was unavailable for comment. I know.
Yeah. We got to bring that back. Well, you should know at some point in time. Really, we do. But I really like the end of the day. You know, they watch the show, grunt in approval, and then they just eat the performers. I mean, that's a wonderful, wonderful family outing for a Trolloc.
Yeah, I know.
Well, first they eat the performers, and then they eat the performers' horses.
Oh, not the horses.
And their little dogs too.
I'll eat you and your little dog too. That would be Mrs. Nard, probably, huh?
See, now I'm just imagining a Trolloc with green fur.
I'm imagining the Wizard of Oz Trolloc edition. It's just, you know.
don't they have the lollipop dance in there?
We represent, midget Trollocs and,
We welcome you to.
Then the wizard would have to be a Mydral. No, the wizard would have to be a Forsaken. The Mydral would probably have to be the Cowardly Lion.
No. No way.
Yep. Scarecrow.
Yeah. A really creepy Scarecrow.
The witches are Mydral. There you go.
Don't make me call out the flying monkey.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Don't make me call out the flying monkeys, I'm telling you. You'll be...
They wouldn't be monkeys. They would be Draenkar. Which are worse than flying monkeys, let me tell you.
What monkeys
can do is pull a straw man apart and throw him around the road.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can fix in a couple of seconds. So you're good. Oh, and steal little dogs. They can do that, too.
How about a little fire, Scarecrow?
You killed the Mydral. And four other companions because they were attached to the Mydral. But that's another story.
Oh, man.
No, see, I can just look at... I can just imagine now Rand and Matt and Perrin all looking at each other and Rand going, wait, you mean we could have thrown water on them this entire time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes. You mean all the blood needed was a good rain and we would have washed it away and we would have been good? Oh, man!
Yeah, what a ripoff! We spent 10 books running from these guys and we could have just hosed them down and gotten rid of them?
Jeez, what the heck? Just... Oh, he's dead! On a slightly more serious note, but only slightly, I had actually forgotten until I read this book that of the connection between Mydral and Trollocs. Anyone else in that category?
No. The Trollocs are sometimes linked to the Mydral. The Mydral are offspring. They're throwback offsprings. Let me get started on genetics again.
That's not what I was referring to. I was referring to the fact that the Mydral can link with the Trollocs, and then the Mydral dies, so does the Trollocs. I had forgotten that.
Right. That's because they're
anyone
related.
Anyone else?
Because they're related.
I had forgotten that. I mean, I knew that Mydrill and Trollocs always came together because the Mydrill were whipping the back of the Trollocs, making sure they went forward. But
well, you know how kids can be so ungrateful, you know.
Yeah. Except that most of them are probably, you know, the Mydrill are probably the children of the Trollocs. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, they are. They are. Yeah, they're throwback offspring of the Trollocs. You know, Mrs. Narg didn't do too well sometimes. You know, Mr. Narg comes home and goes, "That doesn't no look like Narg."
That no
That's
look
not
like
Narg,
Narg.
Baby. Who were you messing with?
Oh. It is interesting. It is interesting on a slightly side note. I know we have a lot of those.
Side note from a side note, yeah.
That it was mentioned by Mr. Jordan in one of the, either Mr. Jordan or Mr. Sanderson, I don't remember which one. There was a discussion on Murdrel and why we never see female Murdrel or anything like that. And apparently, yeah, there's a whole new interesting category of creepiness when it comes to Murdrel, and they're supposed to be sterile, but any children they do produce are stillborn, and it just kind of creepy and weird all at the same time.
Well, it's sort of like mules.
You know what would be really creepy?
If we stayed on topic?
No, that would be a miracle. What would be really creepy is a female Mydrel.
There aren't any.
Nope, there's not.
Don't know why. Well, I do know, but I promised I'd be good. No more genetics. Okay, well, we had a lot of fun with that. The circus, day at the circus for the Trolls.
Yes. And that's our brief moment of humor. In the Fourth Age podcast, we will be 100% serious the rest of the time. Otherwise, we die.
Yeah, exactly. What did we decide about the Saldan horse tricks? I have to know this.
I'm pretty sure we came down on the side of, yeah, they look cool, but how you know, useful are they actually going to be in a battle situation?
I think they're good practice. Baffle the enemy. You know, if you can't overwhelm him with numbers or superior strength, you know, just dazzle him with horse tricks.
That's where the Trolloc Circus came from.
And, that's right.
Yeah, they're going to dazzle the Trollocs into submission. Set up the Trolloc Circus. That's where it came from. Dang it! Now I have to go back and listen to find out what podcast that was and listen to it.
Yeah.
All right.
I wonder if you know, Valenluca has managed to acquire any Trollocs for his menagerie.
That would be creepy. I mean, his wife is an animal trainer. She might be able to pull it off.
If she's weird enough, she could probably intimidate them just as well as any Murdrel you've ever met.
Oh, yeah. That'd be creepy. All right, I think, are we ready to move on now? Because we got just a little bit more here from Chad. I'm skipping a section because that's been brought up over and over and over again. We're good. But he has this question. He says it's something about we were talking about the Shaunchan animals, and we said that RJ or Brandon or somebody said that they were brought from other realms by the Aes Sedai of Shaunchan before Luthair Paindrag came over and collared them all, of course. And one of us made the statement that it was odd that they would know enough about the portal stones to use them, which, you know, was probably rarer knowledge even than channeling. Channeling? Well, rarer knowledge than traveling. And he completely agrees with that idea. In fact, he always assumed that the worlds represented possibilities where Luthair Paindrag returned sooner, and those animals were native to Shaunchan that were brought back in one scenario where things only left... Where the only things left living because of war or famine or whatever were these creatures, and that was just one permutation of the pattern, which was the world that Rand happened to find himself into. So if we remember, the weird toad grown thing were in the world. He says that it makes more sense and it's a bit more believable than the fact that the Shaunchan Aes Sedai would happen to know how to use the portal stones. And I'm looking for it now because I'm sure, here it is. And I'm in the Big White Book, Chapter 18, which is the exotic animals of Shanchen, and it says that these strange new creatures were not Shadowspawn at all, but the descendants of Beast Bot back from parallel worlds via portal stones during the first 1,000 years after the breaking, probably in an attempt to find aid against the real Shadowspawn. So, obviously we've been told many times that the information in the Big White Book, which is the world of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time, for those of you who don't know, we've been told many times that the information in this book, contained in this book, is no more information than a character of their world would know. Mm-hmm. And so some of it might actually be misinformation. But still, I find it more likely that that they were brought over by Portal Stone than that they were native to Shanchen, when we didn't see any of them in the brief glimpses we had through Ram's eyes of life before the breaking. And we know that the world didn't exist the way that it does now. I mean, the map we see, the world map we see, doesn't look anything near the same as it did before the breaking. And I would love to see a map of this world before the breaking. But I think that if they had existed before then, if they were native to Shanchen, that we would have seen them before then.
Maybe.
So
the only thing that puts even a tentative crimp in that is that Lanfear knew what the Grawlm were called. Now, granted, she was one of the ones who was strong enough and did research into the mirror world, so it's very possible she just had that knowledge and, you know, went into a portal world and went, oh, hey, look, there are Grawlm in this world.
Check it out, you know.
I do think that it, more than likely, yes, we can probably trust, as far as lore-wise, that they were probably brought in close to the breaking, or just before, or just after. That is the reason that they are not widely dispersed and, like, only currently available within the Shanchen Empire.
Yeah, we do know that Shanchen progressed much, much differently than Ranland, even differently than the Wastes. I mean, each civilization progressed much differently. I think Ranland, to me, is the wetlands, you know, that area there that the IO call the wetlands, where, you know, civilization split into multiple parts. The Aiel Waste, again, they split into multiple parts, but they're still all the Aiel. Whereas the Wetlanders, they're not all Aiel. There's the Karhian, the Andorians, the Tiran, etc. And then there's Shanchen and Shainar. Shainar?
Or Shainar. I would say Shainar.
No, not Shainar. No,
Shara.
Shara,
oh,
thank
Shara?
You.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, I was completely confused, going off on weird tangents. But whereas Shanchen and Shara, you know, appear to have, you know, one massive continent that's all ruled by one central government, which, of course, you know, was Luther Paindrag's, was his plan, you know, wherever he landed, was to create this unified world. But, you know, they're still isolated from everywhere else. I mean, each one progressed separately of the others, and so the cultures are completely different. I mean, even before Luther Paindrag got to Shanchen, the culture was completely different. I mean, the Aes Sedai there, those who called themselves Aes Sedai, which were really just the channelers, you know, were all evil scheming peoples, you know, which cemented Luther's idea of what the Aes Sedai were. And then, you know, they have these strange animals that they've bred across the length and width of the nation, or the continent.
Our next email comes from Suzette. She says, "Hi all, I've got a quick question for you. I was wondering how it is that all the people in Robert Jordan's world speak the same language, even if they are geographically remote. For instance, how is it the Aiel speak the same language as the Seafolk? And what about the Shanchen? With them being in an another part of the world and going there when they still spoke the old tongue. How is it they still speak Randlandian? And the Two Rivers is also geographically secluded. I would expect them to be speaking the old tongue still, or at least some combination of the old tongue and modern tongue, especially with the old blood coming out of people like Matt and Egwene. They seem to know the old tongue more instinctively than the rest of the world. Or should I just say Robert Jordan wanted to make everybody understood without added confusion of translation? Thanks, Suzette. I actually went ahead and responded immediately to this in the email, and I think just reading my response is probably the best verbatim answer we could possibly give at this current moment. Basically, what I wrote back was Robert Jordan actually did address this at either a signing or a con a while ago. I don't remember the reference link off the top of my head, and honestly, before recording this show, I didn't go and look it up either. I'm terribly sorry about that. But his answer was basically that all modern languages are a watered-down derivative of the old tongue. Regional dialects differ, and the language as a whole has gone through several iterations, hence Matt and Birgit's conversations and her comment about his accent jumping around a whole lot. It is this phenomenon that makes the true old tongue so difficult to translate into a modern common language. In reality, there probably should be more divergence in speech, particularly between isolated populations, and I assume everyone speaks modern common as a way of creating, or as a way around creating multiple modern languages, in making a work this expansive. It's just so hard to make, oh, look, we've got 8 different countries and they all need different languages. It just works easier if everyone speaks a kind of common dialect. The easiest way to compare the modern common language in Randland and the Old Tongue is to look at pretty much any work in Middle English and or Old English in comparison to Modern English. Chaucer wrote primarily in Middle English, and if you're good, you can pick out about 80% of what he's saying without translation. But if you take it even one step further back into Old English, or what is sometimes called Anglish, it's almost impossible to see where our modern speech developed from the original. This is a short clip of Middle English followed by its modern counterpoint. Chaucer, in the very beginning of the Canterbury Tales, writes, "One of Avril with his shores suta, the drought of March hath persed to the ruta, and bathed every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the fleur." The direct translation, as close as my kind of nearly defunct understanding of Middle English goes, reads something like this. "When that April, with certain sweet showers, the drought of March has pierced to the root and bathed every vein in quick liquor, of which virtue engendering is the flower." And that, translated loosely into our modern tongue, becomes, "When in April, when sweet showers fall, that pierced March's drought to the root and all, and bathed every vein in liquor that has the power to generate therein and sire the flower." I apologize if anyone in the listening audience is already familiar with the translational aspect of the English language, but it does demonstrate how modern Randlandian or Randish derived from what developed from the old tongue seen in the book. The old tongue would be just one step older with the two examples of Middle English and early modern English as intervening sub-dialects. I also apologize that there's not an old English / English version of Chaucer's text to give you an example of the gap between the true old tongue as it existed in the Age of Legends to set against the rest. While the Two Rivers is cut off, it has only been so for a few generations. I think at one point prior to Morghese, and possibly Trigrain's mother's reign. Tax collectors and National Guard probably made the trek to the western reaches of the realm, but over time the hassle of it became more than the benefit was worth. This is something like what happened to the Roman Empire. Though they conquered the British Isles, and you can still find Roman influence and ruins in England, Scotland, and Ireland, eventually the empire was just too large to sustain, and the outer provinces fell off and kind of developed a kind of self-rule that eventually developed into autonomy. A lot less time has passed for the citizens of the Two Rivers, though, so they haven't fallen away from Andor yet. Had events not occurred as they did in the series, I would expect they probably would have become their own nation again within a couple hundred years, being generous. I mean, it could have been as little as 100 years. Nevertheless, they weren't cut off completely from the outside, so their language would be much closer to the language of other mainland people than those who were completely isolated, like the Shanshan. Bear in mind also that the Shanshan do have several components to their language that are much more tied to the Old Tongue and its derivatives, and therefore seem foreign to mainlanders. C.A. Mosiev is probably not pure Old Tongue. But anyone who knows enough of the Old Tongue could understand that it means eyes downcast, roughly. But the Shanshan use it in a cultural context that probably didn't exist even in the Age of Legends. At any rate, I hope this answers your question. I'm guessing the others let me handle this one because of my penchant for fictional languages. And if anyone else, and this is your chance, Virginia and Spencer, has the link I mentioned, and I can't remember or sees any huge mistakes that I've made, don't be shy and please chime in, because I think I've been speaking for a good 10 minutes now.
Well, all I got to say is that in high school, I got to memorize that bit of Chaucer, too, and so I think I still remember it, right? And there's probably just the differences in people that read it and everything, but I have to show off, so I'm gonna do this from memory, but I'm not even reading that email. Because I remember it as, when met a prel with its sure soda, the druk of marsha persa to the roda, and bothered every vein in sush liqueur, of which virtue engendered is the fleur. When the young son hath in the ram is half the course of runa, then doth folk long to go on pilgrimages. And I think I've left out a line in there, but I could be wrong.
I don't have the chapter in front of me at the moment.
Stuff that you remember.
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
I mean, the stuff that you remember. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, but that sticks in my mind.
But it's not important, so it doesn't matter. I did find
yeah,
the link to...
Doth Spencer dismiss the benefits of a classical education.
No.
I was talking about your breakfast yesterday.
Yeah, personally, I had the benefits of a Sunnydale education. Thanks very much.
I did find the link that you you wanted there, Andrew, for the interview where RJ talks on why everyone speaks the same language. And for those of you playing along at home, you can find that by going to bit.ly/WOT interviews. That's WOT interviews. There's a large list of topics, and this is under the Old Tongue heading, obviously. And it's an excerpt from a Budapest Q&A in April of 2003. The questioner asks, everybody spoke in the Old Tongue, and then RJ says, English has absorbed words from other languages as recently as the last 10 years. American English in particular is a sponge. The thing is that most Americans think they know no foreign words whatsoever, but if you sit them down with a test, you find that the average American knows 20 or 30 words of French, 20 or 30 words of German, or, you know, maybe as many as 50 or more than that from Spanish, probably close to 100 words from Spanish, and between 50 and 100 from Italian and from other languages as well, because they have been absorbed into American English. Questioner, but in the Wheel of Time world, you don't have this flux of languages. You don't actually have many different languages. Even the Shanshan speak the same language. From RJ, and I set that up deliberately because, you know, one of the things about a world that believes in a circular nature of time is that they believe that there is no real possibility of change. It's one of the things that burden India, as you might know. Whatever I do to affect change, the Wheel of Time, which is a Hindu concept, which, and from others as well, but the Hindus believe in that, Whatever I do to effect change, the wheel will turn and all things will return to being as they are now. Therefore, my effort to effect change is essentially useless. The great gift to the world of the ancient Greeks is that they were the first culture to conceive of time as being linear, which allows for change. I can change things. I can change the future, and it will not return to what it is now because time passes on. It does not double back. So I have a wheel of time world, where there is a belief in the reincarnation and the belief that things will return to, not exactly the way they are now, but essentially as they were two tapestries, and you look at them from across the room, and they look identical. And it's only when you get close to them that you can see the differences. I begin to think also of the periods involved. Do you know why the mountains in this world are so incredibly rugged? Why there are so few passes? The mountains are only a little over 3,000 years old, and there's no mountains in the world that are only... There are no mountains in the world that are only 3,000 years old. There are no mountains in the world that don't have hundreds of thousands or millions of years of wind and water erosion to have worn them down. These mountains, the ones in the book, are in their infancy. And in this world, B have had three distinct 1,000-year periods. B have had, roughly, from the breaking of the world to the Trolloc Wars, from the Trolloc Wars to the War of 100 Years, and from the War of 100 Years to today. Not quite 1,000 years in each case. Some were perhaps a little bit more, but in each case, what has happened is you have a mixing of the population during the turbulence, the nations breaking apart, the production of a lingua franca for these people to communicate with one another, and I probably accented that wrong, I'm sorry, and not enough time for that lingua franca to degenerate into distinct languages which are no longer intelligible to one another. And that is enough so that the people of today could not understand the people from before the Trolloc Wars, who were speaking something very close to the Old Tongue, if not the Old Tongue itself. But they can understand the people of the Shanchen, who were speaking the language of Arthur Hawkwing's time, which had not had time to break down into separate languages. You see, and any events of it breaking down into separate languages was modified by their getting together. So what's happened over the space of just 1,000 years is they think each other have strong accents. It's like I'm speaking to somebody who speaks English, and he's a Jamaican. I don't understand him very easily, or he's a Nigerian. I don't understand him very easily, and he's a native English speaker. We can understand one another, but it's not easy. And the show breaks have just been engaged. Screech!
That's somewhere I was going to go, and I just don't remember what it was now.
And there's even more in here on the Old Tongue. Not all of it is pertinent to what we have here, and so not all of it needs to be brought up. I think that's specifically the one you was referring to. And of course, we want to thank Therese, the wonderful Therese, who is from Theoryland, who has put together this interview database. She's probably the Jennifer Liang of Theoryland. I don't know.
Well, that was a major diversion. I believe that's the first time we've ever tangented off into Chaucer. So, thank you, Andrew, for that.
It wasn't a tangent. It was perfectly on topic.
No, it's cool. It's very cool.
It just seemed to me when I read the email, and I kind of apologize, too, because I didn't really hop on it as fast as I probably would have. Things had been really busy right around that time, and I suddenly looked at it and I was like, oh, it's like nobody's answered this email, and it's a really good email and deserves a really good, and so I made myself sit down for the amount of time it actually took me to, you know, research the lines that I wanted to use and actually sit down and write the email out, and it was really fun, and I really do like fictional languages and, you know, well, languages in general. I am not a philologist, but at the same time, there is something interesting about the way things are put together. If you go back to the interview with Team Jordan, you know, one of my primary questions that I asked was about the Old Tongue and its origins and where it came from. And I was, in that particular interview, was blown away at how many different languages influenced the creation of the Old Tongue, much more than I actually had expected. So it was really nice to be able to see a question like this and to actually sit down and be able to do a little bit of work in answering it. So that was, yeah. It was really nice.
Somebody, you know, plays right into your specialty, you know.
So thank you, Suzette, for that email, Andrew, for the response you gave, because, and I'm glad you did it, because most of that goes right over my head. I tend not to think that much about those things. But
Spencer had a nice nap while he was.
Exactly. I was just no. Moving on now to another email message. This one from. Yeah, this one from Jeremy Carr. And from Jeremy Carr, he says, I wanted to say something about episode 86 and the discussions of Demondred that pretending to be Rand in Maesma's visions. He also posted this on the 4th Age forum, but not too many people look there, and you all should. bit.ly/4thAgeForum, I think. Pretty sure it is. I'll check that one out. But he had a completely different take on who could have been playing Rand in Maesma's visions. It makes more sense if it were Taim, to his mind, and not the Demondred impersonating Rand. And the reason he says this is twofold. Number one is Egwene's dream in A Crown of Swords, Chapter 10, where Loghain, laughing, steps over Rand's body onto a black platform. And when she touches Rand's face, it dissolves. From that, he'd say that someone is impersonating Rand, and that is the other person that Loghain is going to step over. Of course, we all know that sometime soon there's going to come a Loghain-Taim duel. So if Loghain is stepping over anyone's body onto a black-raised platform, it's going to be Taim taking over the Black Tower. But also, number two is remember the Black Ajah plot to set Taim up as a fake Dragon Reborn, which was in Shadow Rising. Joya and Amiko are questioned, and Joya, who was the one who wasn't stilled, says that Leandrin means to kidnap Taim and set him up as a false Rand. I'll come back to that because I just had a thought. He says, I think I remember that one of the oaths the Black Sister swears that they cannot compromise any current Black Ajah events. From that, maybe we can take... Oh, yeah. And there goes my thought. I should have kept reading. From that, maybe we can take the line of thought that Joya was lying about who was going to kidnap Taim, or perhaps she could talk about it because it had already happened. If so, Taim wasn't set up as Rand yet, unless he was the one impersonating him to Maesma. However, he does act in Rand's name. And since Taim might be impersonating Rand, Loghain can walk over his body and reclaim the Black Tower. On a side note, from events in Towers of Midnight, he thinks it's pretty obvious that Taim has been turned by the 13-13 combination. When he first shows up in Camelin, Bashir doesn't recognize him. We found out that when someone is forced to the Dark One, they look the same and have the same memories, but something about them is off. Notice Taim's constant smirk or half-smile. The Ashaman from Loghain's group that is recruited to Taim is noted smiling, and Andoral thinks that he's never smiled before. This is interesting. I mean, he did point out that Joya, who was the one who hadn't been stilled, was the one who said that there was a plot to set up Taim as a false dragon. And as he points out also, we know that one of the oaths is they cannot betray the Black Ajah, or how was it Varen put it? Can't betray the Dark One until the hour of their death or what have you.
Yeah.
And so it wouldn't surprise me actually to find out that what she said there was a blatant lie to throw them off. Also, he points out that it could just be she could talk about it because it had already happened. Or it had been an idea that had been discarded, you know, any of the others. Taim impersonating Rand, though, that's an interesting thought. I'm going to stop talking and let you two go, and I might pop in again later. So what do you guys think?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Taim was, you know, appearing to people as Rand. The thing is, I'm just not sure how he could do it. You know, how is he going to appear to someone in their dreams? Has he been given the, key to entering Teleron Rod in the flesh, or...
at all.
Well, did it say that Taim appeared to Massima in his dreams? Because, I mean, obviously the last time that we see or whoever it is impersonating Rand, they're there. I mean, Massima's there and he sees a holy vision and then,
yeah,
you know,
right.
Gets himself cut down.
Oh, I don't think he saw them there. The last time we hear about it is Massima says, last night the Lord Dragon came to him and told him that Paranaybara must die. To my mind, it sounded like the person who was appearing as Rand wasn't doing it in his dreams. It felt to me like they were actually there, similar to what Misana did with Alviarin. And what Semirag apparently had done with whatever her name was, who got turned into a Dekoval. But
Soroth.
Yeah, Soroth. And it sounded more like, you know, a personal, actual visit than influence of dreams.
You may be right. Yeah, I could be very wrong about that. It was the first thing that popped into my head, so apparently I can't think after all.
Yes, you can. I know you can. Yes, you can.
Or you think badly. Which one?
Well, I think badly, but that's beside the point.
Hmm.
But another thing that I had come to my mind is in our talks about Towers of Midnight, it's come up that apparently, and I think the general consensus of the podcasters is that, you know, what's happening at the Black Tower is initiates are being turned. But there's also a theory put forward that has merit to it, that Taim is Mordeth. He's not a puppet of Mordeth, but he actually is Mordeth, the reincarnation of Ishamiel. And if that's true, then I can't buy into the Taim is pretending to be Rand Al'Thor. If it is true, or if it isn't true, if Taim is a puppet to one of the Forsaken, or maybe he's been raised and is a new Forsaken. We don't know that hasn't happened. If Taim is not Mordeth, is not Morden.
Morden.
Yeah. Have I been saying Mordeth this whole time? Good gosh.
I was getting kind of confused there.
Morden. Sorry. So every time I had said Mordeth in this current conversation, substitute Morden and you'll be fine 5 minutes later. But if Taim is not Morden, then I have no problem believing that he would have been the one pretending to be Rand, pretending to be the Lord Dragon. Not Rand Al'Thor. I mean, that's definitely not pretending to be Rand Al'Thor. They are playing the part of the Lord Dragon, which is a completely different person than Rand Al'Thor.
A glorious glowing figure. Suspended
yeah,
in the air.
Creepy!
Before this email arrived, I actually had forgotten Bashir's original reaction to Taim when he arrives, and I went back and actually looked it up. Bashir took the advantage of the silence. This is in Lord of Chaos, Chapter 2. "You say you're Mazrim Taim." He sounded doubtful, and Rand looked at him in confusion. Was this Taim or not? Only a madman would claim that name if it was not his. The prisoner's mouth quirked in what might have been the beginning of a smile, and he rubbed his chin. "I shaved Bashir." His voice held more than a hint of mockery. "It is hot this far south, or had you not noticed? Hotter than it should be, even here. Do you want proof of me? Shall I channel for you?" His dark eyes flickered to Rand, then back to Bashir, whose face was growing darker by the minute. "Perhaps not that. Not now. I remember you. I had you beat at Irinjavar until those visions appeared in the sky, but everyone knows that. What does everyone not know that you and Mazrim Taim will?" Focused on Bashir, he seemed unaware of his guards or their swords still hovering near his ribs. "I hear you hid what happened to Musar and Hachari and their wives." The mockery was gone, and he was just relating what had happened now.
They shouldn't have tried to kill me under a parlay flag. I trust you found them good places as servants. All they'll really want to do now is serve and obey. They won't be happy otherwise. I could have killed them. They all four drew daggers. And at that point, Bashir has a reaction that makes him recognize Taim despite the memories being different, or the memories being the same, and despite him looking different. So I could possibly take that as evidence that, you know, maybe Taim originally wasn't just a dark friend or, you know, a budding dreadlord, but had, in fact, been turned.
Well, and there's other subplots that can be applied to this situation as well. I mean, there's the idea out there that Bashir is a dark friend, or that, you know, reading that, you know, if Bashir's reaction is kind of sudden and or violent enough, it could be assumed that Morden. How would one combine Taim and Morden? Morim? I don't know.
Yeah, I would call him Tyshamiel.
Tyshamiel, there's a good one. I like that one. That Tyshamiel had laid a compulsion on him with the true power, which Rand wouldn't have been able to sense.
How about Tamoradrid?
Tamoradrid? Maybe. But,
Demandin?
No, he's not Demandred. We know that Taim is not Demandred. That's been blatantly laid out by Robert Jordan.
But I was thinking of Morden,
I also have to wonder, does Taim, Mazarim Taim, even exist before Ishamael is killed?
You hear about him because later in that paragraph I just read from, Rand says, you know, Taim says something like, I hear you killed the Dark One, and Rand says, no, not the Dark One. He called himself Balazam, and I think he was a Shamiel. I killed him later in the Stone of Tyr. And it was during the battle in which Rand fought Ishamiel in the sky that the vision knocked Taim off his horse, and that's how he lost the battle to Dovrum's forces.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that does make sense.
Well, there are also, I don't know if these are red herrings or not, but there's also a scene where Taim is walking with Javindra and Pavara through the Black Tower, and he's carrying one hand behind his back, clenched in a fist, which we see Rand put his hand behind his back because he's lost the hand. And then we've also seen, you know, Morden acting as though his left hand pains him. So there's a apparent connection there. Whether it's a real one or not remains to be seen.
Could be
just a coincidence. But on the other hand, when he's done that in the past, you know, with the mannerisms of the Mithana hiding as the Aes Sedai Daenela, they've actually been real clues, you know, so I think that may be a real clue, not just a red herring.
Yeah. There's so much in these books that everyone pours over. I mean, just picking it apart and saying, oh, well, this, 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 and this, and others will counterpoint with, well, this, this, and that. But, you know, until Robert Jordan comes down in Beam of White Light and or the next book is released, we won't actually know. So, I could go for either or both. I could go for both. I want both to happen. Would that be okay? Can I get both of those? So, but it seems to me that that all of this is just rampant speculation until we have a lot more. I mean, even Mithana as Daenel was rampant speculation, albeit fairly well-grounded speculation until, you know, we actually got the one throwaway line that, oh yeah, they found Mithana, it was Daenel.
I was right.
Yeah.
Finally, you got one.
But back to the main topic, Taim impersonating the Lord Dragon, I could see it, assuming that Taim is not Morden.
I could see it even if he was Morden. I could see Morden impersonating the dragon to try and create more chaos. We don't think that order's been lifted, do you?
Yes, but it's not Moradin's MO. It's not the way Moradin would operate. I could see what we know of it, what we know of Taim. I could see Taim doing it, but what we know of Ishamael and Moradin, I couldn't. And that sounds really weird when I say that they're the same.
He likes to manipulate others to do it for him.
Yeah, well, that's true. He could have sent one of his Ashaman with heavy compulsion to go do it.
That's true, but you know, there's some things you just have to do yourself if you want them done right.
Well, in that case, why doesn't he get to kill him himself?
Well, because I think he's forbidden from killing him. Probably the Dark Lord has forbidden him, the Dark One. The Dark Lord, I'm alright. He's probably forbidden him to kill him. So
well,
he has to
eat. Yeah, Rand can't be killed. We know that it's been forbidden for Rand to be killed.
He has to use lackeys or, you know.
But
make sure
Perrin
nobody can discover
Matt,
him.
Seriously, Perrin and Matt, why doesn't someone just, you know, travel into, you know, the Matt's tent and stab a knife in his heart? Why hasn't that happened yet?
They tried. You're just lucky, remember? He's the Lord
of
Luck.
Or Perrin. Good freaking gosh. Why have this elaborate setup? Oh, yes, a dream spike with a Slayer inside of it, and then we're going to portal stone in a whole bunch of Trollocs, and we're just going to overrun them. Why?
Because they're scared of Fael. Are you crazy?
Seriously, before the entire those three entire books where Fael is missing, Perrin didn't even know where he was sleeping half the time. He wakes up in Berlaine's tent.
Berlaine,
whatever. So
yeah, that is no big deal.
How can I not just travel into his tent and stab him in the heart? How is that not a possibility? Why just open a small gateway above his chest and stab him through it and then retreat through that same gateway? Why go through these elaborate measures? I mean,
I don't know, but you know,
sometimes
people,
supervillainry.
Sometimes people just miss the obvious, you know? Like when, and totally going off topic here, but like when, was it Kindler? It's one of Taim's pet Ashaman was taunting Andral, the gateway guy that they call the page boy. He can make a gateway. He can make a gateway anything from the size of a postage stamp up to, you know, a couple of carts wide. You know, this guy's sitting here taunting him and everything. Why can't he use, why can't he open a little gateway inside rock and blow it up that way? And, you know, why doesn't, better yet, because Virginia's just got a sick, twisted mind, why doesn't he open a little tiny gateway right in the middle of his brain and cause him to stroke out and drop dead on the ground? Duh.
Well, he didn't kill him because he had way too much backup, and if he had killed him, then the Andral probably would have been killed. But, opening a gateway in the middle of the rock and split it in half, and then we're...
I mean, if he opens a little tiny gateway inside his head and his head, he has a bleeder and strokes out and dies, nobody's going to know.
Yes, they can. They can see other men's wheeze. They would be able to see the wheeze going into the other guy's head. He doesn't know how to invert them.
Well, he doesn't have to do it right in front of them.
Well, no, but, you know.
We
really don't want him to be that kind of person because there's enough of them at the Black Tower, and it's scary enough. And they haunt my dreams. I'm kidding.
Are you saying I'm scary? Wait a minute.
And honestly, it's probably because Candler would rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so can you drop that? You can just have yeah, I love it.
One of the classic little jokes.
Yeah.
I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
Yeah, it would work. I mean, you know, shut the guy up for one thing.
as to though, seriously, and I don't know why I'm continuing this conversation, but the reason he doesn't use a gateway to destroy the rock is because Candler is specifically wanting him to use the weave for exploding the rock that, you know, Candler pretty much knows is that Andril's going to fail at.
Yeah, you know, beyond him.
It is the mark of the evildoer that how will you know that they're evil unless they do something appropriately evil that can be identified for?
Right.
Why? You know, what good is the concept of being evil if you can't build death rays and giant mutant monsters?
What's the good in being an evil supervillain if your traps are so elaborate that your heroes can get out of them because one thing goes wrong? Sort of wrong. It just has to slightly go wrong, and then they get out of it because it's too freaking elaborate and it collapses in on itself.
Well, the same reason that they have to leave the hero alone in the room in order to give them time to escape from those...
Exactly! Or time for their sidekick to show up and free them. I mean, seriously, you have the guy at gunpoint, shoot him in the head. Shoot him in that.
Well, I know, but they also want to talk to him. They also want to talk to him for some going like, you know, talk to him, just, you know.
I mean, come on. The series started with a villain ranting.
Well, yeah, I know.
And what did it cause? It caused Luce Thurin to go kill himself. So there you go. Yeah. Sometimes the evil villain ranting has a purpose.
That wasn't the work of that evil villain, though. That was the work of that evil villain's boss.
Okay.
He went and killed himself because he went insane because of the taint.
Yeah, right. I'm just glad that my rants have caused him to go kill himself. That I know of. the series probably isn't doing me any good. I'm also the one who thought about, actually, I thought about, it's really hysterical to see this in Towers of Midnight, because that was actually my favorite trick for getting rid of the dead bodies. You know, I said before, I couldn't understand why Halima drags the body of the maid to the snow to hide her, you know, dodging troopers and all this other stuff and making this big effort of it. Just open the gateway and shove her in. You know, let her fall
the
through.
The skimming gate,
yeah, you know. Hello?
She's gone. Or just, you know, incinerate the body right there. I mean, you can channel. I mean, you channel to kill her.
Well, yeah.
Why not just incinerate the body, turn it into ash?
Well, that might, you would smell something burning or, you know, there might be some
ash. If you incinerated it.
It is always.
Well, yeah, there's some ash left.
There's some ash left. Somebody might notice the smell or whatever. I could understand not doing that, but just open the skimming gateway or a gateway into, you know, someplace far, far away, another planet, or I don't know. And just shove it in. It's gone. No evidence. Perfect.
Seriously, dump it in the middle of the Aerith Ocean. What can you do?
Weave a
huge rock to their feet and thrown through the gateway into the middle of the Aerith Ocean, and they're gone.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't even have to be dead before you throw them. You're good.
Yeah, I know. I'm telling you, it's like the perfect crime. It's really great. It reminds me of that, I don't know if you've been watching the last season of Futurama or whatever, which is now, they go, they're in a recycling binge or whatever, and Bender looks at one of these recycling hover dumpsters and decides this looks like the perfect place to hide some evidence, you know. The professor comes up and says, what are you doing? Nothing. Shut up. Your mama. Take your pick. I can't imitate Bender properly, but, you know, it's like Halima. Yeah, what are you doing? Nothing. Just disposing of the body. Leave me alone.
Yeah, just get rid of it. No body, no crime.
That's right. Habeas corpus and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
I think we've wandered far enough on this topic. We've only been recording for 3 hours. Let's keep going. We can't have been recording for 3 hours. It's not 10 o'clock yet, and we started at 7. We started after 7. Why is this at 3 hours? I don't know. I must be reading the wrong thing.
I don't have time for a grudge match with every poser in a parka.
Yeah. Shall we go on? I think this is one of the more interesting ones. Andrew, will you do the honors?
Sure. This email comes to us from Simon, and he asks, what happens if a shadow spawn is killed in Hinderstap? Since everyone seems to be reborn, Would this hold true for Shadowspawn as well? The place would be locked in eternal battle.
I guess the question is, if people are killed, or if people are killed during the daytime, do they get reborn the next day? I mean, we know that at night everyone dies and they're all reborn the next day. But what about during the daytime?
That's a good question.
Because if they just get a whole bunch of them together and kill the Trolloc or other Shadowspawn during the daytime and it's dead during the daytime, will it come back the next daytime and then they'll have to go kill it all over again?
But didn't somebody... Well, if they run away during the daytime, they get brought back. So I'm guessing if they got
or
killed
nighttime.
Or tried to...
Oh, yeah, daytime. That's true.
Yeah, yeah. Or I was thinking if they, you know, got killed or tried to kill themselves during the daytime, they'd probably just get brought back too.
My biggest question is, do they remember them last night? I mean, it doesn't seem like they remember much of the last night. I mean, they were expecting to find Matt and his cadre stuff somewhere. I mean, they didn't have any beds left, but...
From what the mayor said, in the few moments that we saw the mayor, he seemed to say that the events of the previous night seemed to them like some sort of monstrous dream, like a nightmare.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I do remember.
And that they don't remember it perfectly, but they remember enough that it seems like they wake up as if they hadn't slept all night, which they kind of haven't, and, you know, and they're always troubled by whatever they experienced when they were asleep. I don't know what would happen if anyone died during the day. I assume they'd probably get incorporated into the rotating, you know, eternal cast of near rage virus like pattern bendiness. But I don't think we, you know, heard about anybody going, I just can't take these nights anymore. Goodbye, cruel world. Crossbowed.
Well, it's interesting, though, that you point out that they aren't getting any sleep. So sooner or later, they're going to have to all die from sleep deprivation.
Except the pattern won't.
And what effect
them.
Will that have? Well, if they die during the day, and not just run away, if they are dead during the day, will they come back the next night? I don't know.
I think we may have just found our solution for Hinderstab.
Just kill everyone during the daytime. I did
vow to Balefire the next person who brought up Hinderstab, but...
She would Balefire you, Simon, but you're in Brisbane and she's not, so we're good.
Well, I could travel, but I forgot that weave, too.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
But that definitely goes on the list of things we need to ask a member of Team Jordan about as soon as possible. What happens if someone dies during the day in Hinderstab?
They could drag back, I'm convinced.
Maybe. I don't know. Moving on, though, the last one of this episode, this is from Rob Cormier. My apologies if I'm mispronouncing names, because I'm not perfect. I'm sorry. I can pretend really well, but I'm really not that perfect.
You better work on that.
Yeah, I try.
Yeah,
but he says, hey, everyone at the Fourth Age. I was just listening to your guys' recap of the Gathering Storm, and you were talking about the possibility that Massima was being used by one of the Forsaken, but none of you brought up the idea that the Forsaken doing it is the Mandred. Why didn't we organize these better? We talked about this earlier. But the whole series, we are told that he is up to something, but we are never told what. And even at one point, he can't remember in what book or what Forsaken said it, but one of them said that the stuff going on in the West had the Mandred all over it. I think that was actually Samael to Grendel, and he said events of the South have the Mandred's mark. So just wondering what your thoughts are on this, and if you think it's possible, please tell me why. I have tried to find something to say that is wrong, but I have come up with nothing. The Mandred is actually my first choice for who would be portraying the Lord Dragon to Massima. Obviously, Massima isn't his only pawn in the game, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was one of his pawns. Again, when we went back and talked about Taim and Massima, I think we hit a lot of this discussion. We didn't really go into the why Demandred is a better idea than Taim. We went into why Taim is a good idea, but still. Do we want to continue talking about Massima a little bit?
Glad he's dead.
Yeah, who isn't? Who isn't glad he's dead? But, you know, that was a really, I think that was, I don't know about you two, but when I read that line in Gathering Storm that, you know, the Lord Dragon had visited him last night and said Perrin must die, I was like, oh my gosh, suddenly everything makes sense, and this is a much more interesting thing now. Before it was just, yeah, my thought was just, Massima's crazy. He's just gone off the deep end, flown the coop, he's cuckoo nuts, and he's dragging people along with him. But now the idea that he is being led by some mysterious third party, claiming to be the Lord Dragon, you know, it's much more interesting, and now, you know, my next read-through, I'm going to be looking for that a whole lot closer, is more hints of who may or may not be behind what Massima is doing.
Yeah, well...
Or Maesma.
I don't know.
I think Maesma is actually the proper way to say it.
It what?
I think I've been mispronouncing Maesma by saying Massima.
I thought it was Massima.
Yeah. I don't care either way, you know who I'm talking about, so...
I have a hard time believing that he was so crazy as to think that, you know, the Lord Dragon would have even said to do some of the things that allegedly he was told to do. I mean, some of it doesn't even make sense to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, he was obviously crazy, but also you have to think that he didn't know Rand all that well. I mean, he spent a few months I think they spent a few months in the Mountains of Mist, and, you know, weeks before that, well, probably maybe as much as a month, if you count the time they spend in Faldara and the time they spend traveling, not the time that Rand was in the alternate world while the Hunt for the Horn was still traveling, but...
Right. Mm-hmm. Well,
still,
you
know,
a possibility.
He wouldn't have known Rand that well.
There's
so
always a
I don't think he would
that...
know what Rand was...
Yeah, you're right. And there's always a possibility that he had compulsion worked on him as well, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm less inclined to agree with that one, because as far as we've seen, there's no way to really fight off compulsion. I mean, obviously, stubborn minds, it takes a little bit more to compulse them, but there's no real way to fight it off. And yet, as he's dying, he kind of seems to snap back to lucidness. You know, his, have I done well, Father?
You have a really broad definition of lucid.
No, I think that's acceptable for someone dying to have that kind of, you know, people who are generally sane, most people would consider sane, would still have that kind of experience as they were, you know, bleeding out through the gut.
Hmm. Never done it, so.
No, it's not something I've ever experienced either. So, yeah, that's Massima. And that's actually the last of the emails we have for tonight. For those of you who have sent us emails that they didn't show up here, I'm sorry. We can't get to all of them. We've been going for a good while now. Hopefully we'll have a nice length of podcast. For those of you who want to send us an email that we will respond to, may or may not actually end up in an episode. We might just have a nice back and forth through email. But you can do that by emailing podcast@dragonmount.com. And everyone on the podcast team, plus some others, get that. So you have a wide pool of people that will be reading your email, potentially reading your email and responding.
Well, everybody reads it. Sometimes you don't get time to answer it back, but everybody, sometimes if, just depending if the timing's right, you know, you'll get two or three people answering.
Yeah. And you can get answers in as little as a couple minutes, too.
Sometimes.
Depending on what people have going on. Yep.
I'm staring at my iPhone, you might hear back right away.
If Virginia's really, really bored and just hoping for something to happen, and you email her, she'll be like, yes! I'm kidding.
It's very possible. I'll do almost anything to get out of work.
Anyway.
Anything to get out of working. We do definitely read all the emails. We thank you all for writing in. Same thing for voicemails. Anytime you want to put in your 2 cents worth, you know, be assured that we are interested. And odds are pretty good that you will get your email or your voicemail on the podcast. We've fallen a little behind doing it lately because we've been doing the read-throughs and so forth and so on. But probably get most of them. If we miss one, you know, we apologize. Feel free to send it again, you know, because we might just... This one, you know, collecting them mainly. But thanks again for everybody who has written in.
We will also be getting to another listener voicemail episode sometime soon. So if you wanted to call and leave us a voicemail, you can do so at 1-888-333-7690.
And also, if you want to visit our forums, which is where most of the conversation happens these days, you know, we don't have the open comments that we had on the old DM server on DM 8.0. Our homepage is different, so we don't have the wonderful conversations that we used to have in the comment section after each episode, but we do have them in the forum section. We're trying to have them in the forum section. And so you can find the Fourth Age Forum by going to bit.ly/Fourth Age Forum. Really original, I know, but it's easy to remember. And talking about our homepage, you can find that at dragonmount.com/podcast is the URL that you want to use for that one. And of course, you know, there are the more conventional ways of getting a hold of us. You know, the internet is such this new strange thing. There are the more conventional ways of getting a hold of us. You know, carrier pigeon, message cow.
LOL.
And the small mail slot gateways. If you can find that one.
If you can find Andrawl, you know.
Yeah, if you can find Andrawl to get you a message gateway or someone else equally skilled, just please, if you're going to use gateways, then please send the warning chime ahead so that we know to clear the area so that you don't kill somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely tragic at our house when the family cat got split in half by a gateway because of a letter from our aunt. Which, oddly enough, you know, it was actually a package from our aunt, which, oddly enough, had a cat sweater in it. But the cat was in pieces, and it was sad.
Poor kid, I got gateway'd. Well, that'll wrap this episode up. We had a lot of fun, and we hope you did, too. So this is Virginia wishing you all the best, and may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
For myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyananto Manshima, Daishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.
Okay, now returning from the edit.
Please.
From the long and bold edit.
And honestly, I know you probably, whoever is editing this, I know you probably edited for us prior to this. And I just want to say, you really do have to know, we honestly don't do this on purpose. It may seem like we do, but we really don't.
So we're really, really, really asking you to, you know, rescind those contracts that you put out on us, because it's becoming a real problem.
Yeah, we, yeah. Don't hate us, please.